am Paul Harris. Thanks so much for listening and for following me on Twitter at Paul Harris Show or on my website, harrisonline.com. You ever have one of these situations in your life? You drive to work, you park your car, you get out of the car, somebody pulls into the parking space next to you, you look over, you think you recognize him, you're not quite sure who it is, and then it occurs to you, I went to college with this guy 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, however many years ago you were in college. You haven't seen him in all those years. What are the chances that he would be in that parking lot, parking exactly next to you on that specific day? Sounds like a fluke, or maybe it's a coincidence, or maybe it's both. That's why we have my next guest on the line. His name is Joseph Mazur. He is professor emeritus of mathematics at Marlborough College in Vermont and the author of a book called Fluke, The Math and Myth of Coincidence. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Paul. I'm so very glad to be on the show.
What are the odds of that happening?
Well, the odds are actually pretty good. And the reason they're pretty good is that you really expect, you're expecting that your address book is actually going to be bigger than it actually is, but it isn't. It's only 1% of all of the for most people, it's 1% of all the family acquaintances and people you know in the world. So the people you know in the world is much more vast than your address book, for example. So you know an awful lot of people, and the world is very big, and we're very mobile, and that's one reason why we're bumping into people we know who are part of our acquaintance package.
So is that a fluke, or is it a coincidence?
Well, a coincidence by definition is two events that happen in time and space with no apparent cause. Now, of course, there's a cause. But it's not apparent.
Okay.
And so if it's not apparent, then it's a coincidence. And if you don't know why that person is in that parking spot at that particular time, then I would say it's a coincidence. Now, somebody may know, and therefore to somebody else it might not be a coincidence.
Right. But a fluke would be those stories we hear about the blue ice falling off of a plane and it hits a guy in his field on his farm. That's a fluke, right?
That's right. That's a fluke.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Exactly.
So you've got a story in the book that's kind of like the one I used to introduce you. It's a story about a woman in Paris who she and her husband are walking along the Seine. I'll let you finish the story.
Yeah, she and her husband are walking along the Seine. She is a children's book author. Now, this happens in 1929, just before the crash and the stock market crash. But they're having a vacation in Paris, and they just finished lunch, and she's walking along the Seine, picks up a book from a stall, and looks inside. She buys the book, brings it to her husband, and her husband says, "Ah, look inside here. There is a marking here, and it looks like your handwriting and your address." And sure enough, it was her book when she was a child, and her favorite book when she was a child. So the question is, what are the chances of that? Well, you really have to look at the hidden variables. So there are some hidden variables that you uncover, and usually you don't hear those hidden variables in the story because the storyteller is trying to, in some way, sometimes subconsciously, inflate the story as something really, really surprising. But what happens is when you look into those hidden variables, when you search for them, you find some things that will give you clues as to why it happened, why it's more likely to have happened. Now, surely a story like that is very rare. I don't mean to imply that, you know, it's something that would normally happen. It surely doesn't happen normally. Mm-hmm. But when you look into the hidden variables, you see things that you didn't see before. For example, in her hidden variable, her mother was a painter who was a student at a Philadelphia School of Painting, and there at that school was a friend who became a very famous painter and went off to Paris to live in Paris. And there was a certain exchange of childhood books that ended up in Paris. Now, the person died just, it turns out that the person who had the book died just a year or two before Anne Parrish, the author, actually went to the Seine to look for books. So, you know, you put all these things together, you see something that is a little bit more, is pointing you in a direction that suggests that there's that the probability is higher than you think it is.
Yeah, the interesting thing about that story is the woman who is from Colorado was shocked to find this in Paris, and you said it was in 1929.
Yeah.
I would bet you that story is much more likely to occur now, because in 1929, to get to Paris, you had to take a boat, and a lot of people didn't do that.
Exactly.
Now you can fly almost nonstop from anywhere to go to Paris. And
that's one of the other hidden variables, because these people were quite wealthy. She was married to Charles Corliss, who was an industrialist from Philadelphia, a steel magnate. So he could fly or take boats wherever he wanted. And where do rich people go in 1929? Well, they went to either yachting off the Greek islands or to Paris or to luxury places throughout the world. But mm-hmm. There weren't too many in 1929.
There's another story in the book that I wanted to ask you about, because we hear stories about lottery winners. Which means that they were suckers who got lucky.
Yep.
But not only do they win it once, but they win it twice, three times. You have a story in the book about a woman who wins it four times.
Four times, and four times quite large sums. The first time was $5.4 million, the next time was $2 million, the next time was, something like $3 million, and then it was $10 million.
And you say it's not that odd.
It's not odd in one sense. That is, if you say Joan Ginther, the person who actually won the lottery four times, if you say that she will win the lottery four times, the odds of that is astronomical. If you point to her and say, you are going to win the lottery four times, that's astronomical. Yeah. It will happen perhaps, but it's not likely to happen. But if you say there is somebody in the world who will or did or is winning the lottery four times, well, you have thousands of lotteries and millions of people playing the lottery. So if you don't point to the person, then the odds of a person, some person who is not named ahead of time, to win the lottery is quite high, in fact. In fact, it's quite likely that somebody will win it. In the next few years, there'll be another person to win it four times. It's quite likely.
I'm not a mathematician, but I would bet, and I am a betting man, I would bet that there's a higher than 80% probability that that person who wins the lottery four times will then write a book or start a website charging you money and then giving you advice how to win the lottery.
I think what happens is when you win it the first time, you know, $5.4 million the first time, what you do is you don't spend time writing books. You spend time betting again. That's what you do. And that's normal practice. Psychologists call it house money. You know, when you go to the casino and you win big, you've got money to spend because it's not your money, so why not bet again? So more likely than not, she would have bet, let's say, another $1 million, which is a pocket change for after you win $5.4 million. You bet again because it's in your blood. You're going to just have that willingness to do it. So you bet again. And her odds are much better now because with $1 million, she's going to buy, let's say, 500,000 tickets. So there you go.
Yeah.
And then once you do it twice, well, you're definitely going to do it again.
Yeah, I always have to remind my friends who play blackjack to reject that idea of a house money, because as soon as the dealer pushes those chips across the line, it becomes your money.
That's right. It should become your money, but you don't think of it that way.
Yeah, and thinking about those things and numbers in general reminds me of what your fellow mathematician John Allen Paulos, in a book years ago called innumeracy.
Yeah.
You must run into this in your classrooms all the time.
All the time, yes. And you know what happens is, of course, I did teach probability theory, and I would always tell my students, and I would tell my family, be careful in betting on things like lottery, in particular, because, you know, the expected value of your money is very low compared to what you are spending. So, you know, if you're doing, let's say, sweepstakes tickets, let's say, and it costs you, I don't know what the price of a postage stamp is now, 44 cents, it's not worth it. It's not worth, you know, the 44 cents, because the expected value is something like about 5 cents.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been teaching that for years like that, until one day when my wife was in the supermarket, and it was a grand opening of a supermarket, and what happened was she put in a card with my name on it to a sweepstakes, a Pillsbury sweepstakes, and I won big time. I won that Pillsbury stakes big time. And I have to say, it was house money for me, because I started to look at sweepstakes everywhere for months, and I would... I would be, as the person who advocated to not do this, suddenly became a person who was betting on sweepstakes, and I would just enter my name everywhere for the sweepstakes. I never won again, but you know, it somehow died off.
But this goes
maybe 2 or 3 months later, I wasn't doing it anymore.
Well, this goes back to what you were saying before, Joe, which is, you know, the odds of you in particular winning that sweepstakes might have been 100,000 to 1, but the chances of somebody winning it were 1 to 1.
That's right, especially for sweepstakes. Yeah, somebody is going to win a sweepstakes ticket.
Since you wrote this book, Fluke, The Math and Myth of Coincidence, do you have a lot of people coming up to you and asking you, what are the odds of this, or telling you about their coincidences?
Well, ever since I wrote the book, and ever since it's been broadcast on things like Slate Magazine and The Guardian and all of these papers, I've been swamped with stories. I'm the sorcerer's apprentice of coincidence stories. I just can't keep up my head above them, but I have now a collection of over 400, and I'm trying to answer almost every one of them, but I not been able to succeed because they keep coming.
Tells me that the percentages of the probability of you writing Fluke 2 seem pretty high.
Well, people have asked me to do that. In fact, editors have too. So,
how many of those involve dreams? Somebody, I dreamt about my mother being sick, and I woke up in the morning and my mother was calling and she was sick.
Right, but think about the times that you dreamt that your mother was sick and she was not sick.
Yeah.
You have to balance that off. You know, any time that something happens that predicts the future, you have to think about how many times did something happen that predicted the future falsely.
Right. And people always say, I was just thinking about you and you called me. What are the odds of that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, did you count up the number of times you thought about that person and nothing happened?
That's right.
People forget about that sort of stuff.
But isn't it wonderful when it happens? I mean, it really is wonderful when these things do happen.
If it's good news.
We just crave these great stories. That just it makes the world, the scary world that is so large, so vast, it makes it so... it pulls us together. We're all one in those stories.
And
it
helps
us more comfortable in the world.
And helps us, particularly through books like yours, understand that randomness is not really that random.
Absolutely, it's not. We're actually very surprised when we see, if you throw dice 40 times, let's say, and it comes out double sixes 10 times in a row, we're surprised. We think it's not random.
Yeah.
But it is.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's why casinos put in those tote boards next to the roulette wheel.
That's right.
It's showing you what the 10 or 15 previous numbers were. You look up, you go, well, 3 hasn't come up for about 20 rolls. I'm going to have to bet on 3.
It's as if the roulette wheel has a memory.
That little ball knows 3
it
hasn't
knows
come up.
Where to go.
And now
exactly.
It's deciding that it's going to do that.
Yep.
Last thing I've got to ask you about, I was stunned when I learned this. I understand a little bit about math, but not nearly as much as you do. I was stunned to hear that there is a law of large numbers and a law of truly large numbers.
Yeah, they work together in some way. The law of truly large numbers is more or less a philosophical law, and it goes like this. If you come up with a calculation that something has a probability that's not zero, then it could be very small. That probability could be very, very, very small, very close to zero. The law of truly large numbers says that it will happen sometime. Now, it may take a million years for it to happen, but the law of truly large numbers says that it will happen because it's non-zero.
Yeah. That's like that joke about the guy in the bar, and he asked the woman, would you ever sleep with me? And she said, not in a million years. And he says, so I have a chance.
Yeah, well, I guess you could have a chance. Yeah, speed up time.
The book is called Fluke, The Math and Myth of Coincidence. This is Joe Mazur, who's a professor emeritus of mathematics at Marlborough College in Vermont. I've had a great time talking to you. Thanks for your time.
Oh, thanks. I had a pleasure, too.
Joseph Mazur, Fluke, The Math and Myth of Coincidence, here with Paul Harris on the Big 550 KTRS.